Ready?
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call the order of the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 5, 2007. Let the record reflect we have a quorum present. Members in your packets, I've provided copies of two documents that were given to my office late last week that follows up on some of the information we got from the on the Drive to Excellence initiatives. One is memo dated March 22, 2006 from Peggy Ingeson, the then Finance Commissioner. And this was a determination of some of their anticipated savings of that. And then this is a follow-up from the presentation we had from Commissioner Badgerow. We asked her to identify what savings there were. Not quite sure she identifies, you know, with the specificity that I think we're going to be looking for later on, but we did ask for the information, and this is what she provided to us on any monies for the Drive to Excellence. So I just want to close that loop for the time being. Today we have the Investment Board and the Retirement Accounts, and so the first item is the Investment Board. Mr. Bicker, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record. And members, you'll find the Investment Board towards the front of your budget books. It's after the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board. Mr. Bicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Executive Director of the State Investment Board. We provided a handout for the committee that will give you a brief review of the State Board of Investment. The first page just shows the members. There are four members of the board. The governor is the chair. The other three members are the state auditor, secretary of state, and the attorney general. The board is advised by a committee of 17 members, 10 of which are from the local investment community. In addition to them, there's the commissioner of finance, the directors of the three retirement systems, two active employees, and one retiree. And we have a staff of 21 to manage the day-to-day investment operations of the board. Next page just gives you an executive summary of the funds under management. This is as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, 2006. As of that point, the board was responsible for $55.7 billion. You can see from the chart the majority of the assets under the board's jurisdiction is retirement-related assets. But we do a number of other things. We do the state's deferred comp plans. We have a supplemental investment funds, which are available for volunteer fire relief and various other groups. We manage the assigned risk plan, which is part of the workers' comp system. We do the permanent school fund, environmental trust fund, which is proceeds from the state lottery, and the state's general revenue fund, which at that point was $5.7 billion. On page 4 and 5 is a quick summary of our results. Page 5 is our return. One of our bogeys is our return versus inflation. Over the majority of this period, inflation has been relatively easy to beat in the investment environment. You can see on page 6 is our return versus a composite index. The composite index is the returns of the marketplace weighted the same way as our portfolios. You can see last year the combined funds earned 12.3% versus a composite index of 12.2%. You can see over longer periods of time the board has exceeded the actuarial assumed rate. Since we have audited numbers back to January 1st of 1980, which is 26 and a half years, the board has had an annualized return of 11.1%. Mr. Chairman and members, as far as our budget requests, the board requests amount for our investment of state monies, in other words, the general revenue fund. The balance of the budget that the board has is billed back to those who we provide investment services, the majority of which, of course, is the retirement-related funds. So, Mr. Chairman and members, it's a quick overview of the State Board. If there are any questions, I'd gladly respond.
Could you, again, maybe explain how your appropriation, what does that actually fund? Because, again, a lot of the services you provide go to the people who invest with the State Board Investment. How does your appropriation work in paying for the things that you're not billing the customers for?
Mr. Chairman and members, we get a general fund appropriation that is the portion of our budget directly related to the investment of the general fund. Then the board establishes a budget, and we bill back everybody that we invest for on a percentage of assets. So, in other words, if you have 5% of the assets of the State Board of Investment, you are charged 5% of the balance of the budget. And we bill everybody on a quarterly basis.
I didn't ask at the time that we had the legislative auditor in here talking about the post-retirement fund. Is there anything in particular? Are you prepared to discuss any of those matters with us, or is that something that you wish to?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you'd like to discuss the post, obviously the post is an issue that the board is very much aware of. We are working with the retirement systems and their study group that anticipates coming up with a recommendation for the next legislative session. I very much concur with everything that's been in the legislative auditor's report as it relates to the post. It's not a hidden agenda. It's been out. A number of us have been talking about the post for a long time and making various suggestions as to how to modify the benefit increase formula. We think some of the suggestions in the legislative auditor's report are very good suggestions. I don't think the retirement systems disagree either, and hopefully we'll have a proposal for you all to look at next session.
Well, one of the things I think the headlines were that the funds are, there's about $4 million problem or whatever. Keep in mind that the State Board Investment manages funds of, what, $55.8 billion. So $4 billion is a lot of money, but when you look at what the state budget is and look at what they're talking about here, I mean, wow, this, you know, they manage quite a lot of money, and it's nothing to ignore, but on the other hand, you got to put it in context, too. So other questions of Mr. Bicker? Sarah Olsen.
Following up on that, when we were presented with that information, I thought one of the concerns was if having an annual interest return of 10%, and it, you know, to me that seemed kind of like a pipe dream when I look at like my passbook savings account or something. But when I look at your annualized results from 1980, you guys are going over 10% almost every year. So, do you see that as the way to work out of that retirement problem?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, 11.1%, which has been our annualized return for the last 26 years. There's a lot of variability in those numbers. 2001, 2002, 2003 were not fun years. They were negative numbers, which has led to the post issue of $4 billion unfunded liability, which was caused, again, by the formula for benefit increases. The prospects of continuing to earn 11% each year or 10% each year, if we knew all those answers, we would be on our own, so to speak. The problem with the current formula is if you have any one bad year during that five-year period, it really exacerbates the problem. And I think some of the solutions that will be proposed, at least I'm anticipating, will be proposed by the retirement systems, won't necessarily call for us to earn our way out of the situation, but they will take into consideration the assumed rate of 8.5%.
Well, and members, let me just clarify what I said a minute ago. The State Board of Investment manages total assets of about $55.8 billion, but the post side of it is $21.9 billion. So it's less, but it's still a lot of money. Other questions? Anything further? Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Bicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
And then the other items that we have for today, members, in the back of your books are the retirement accounts. And these are there's many retirement accounts funds. These are the major ones. The we have Minnesota Public Employees Retirement account, Mary Vanek. TRA. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is John Wicklund, Assistant Executive Director of the Futures Retirement Association. And as you indicate in your packets are the preliminary biennial budget submissions made last October. In front of you, you should have a one-page meant to review, and I will work off of that. TRA covers public teachers in Minnesota. Members of Minsky who have elected TRA coverage and all charter schools in Minnesota. We have close to 80,000 active member teachers after the merger with the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Association last June. We have about 44,000 benefit recipients, assets of about $17.8 billion as of June 30th. On the one-page handout is a summary of the requested revenues and expenditures for fiscal years 2008 and 2009. I'll start out with the revenues. For the two-year period, we're requesting a revenue budget of $905 million. You can see we've had growth in our revenue budget over the last two fiscal years. A good chunk of that relates to the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement, assuming of the revenue stream from that merger. The increase between fiscal years 2007 and 2008 is largely because employer contribution rates will be going up 0.5% July 1 of 2007 now. Our covered payroll the most recent fiscal year was just shy of $3.5 billion. Our employee contribution rate is 5.5 currently, and as I said, on July 1st, 2007, the employer contribution rate will go up to 5.5 as well. Down below on the expenditures, we're requesting an expenditure budget of $2.94 billion. In the middle there, expenditures by category, it's broken into three categories. The first one is compensation and benefits for our 86 employees. And we have other operating expenses, which is our administrative expenses to keep the doors open. And then other financial transactions are the annuities and refunds that we pay out. About 99% of our operating expenses relate to the annuities and the refunds, and those are benefits that are set by state law and are not discretionary. As you can see, our total full-time equivalents are constant at about 86 for the upcoming two-year period, full-time equivalents of employees. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
You mentioned the Minneapolis appropriation for Minneapolis teachers. Could you go? Some members were aware that we had a real problem last time that was solved in the last legislative session. Could you maybe just go a little bit detail about that, and how long are we going to be on the hook for funds from the state to ultimately resolve that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Up above on the revenues, you can see I put an asterisk there that currently when the merger happened, we TRA assumed all the direct and local state aids that the former Minneapolis Teachers Retirement was receiving at that time. Slightly over $21 million, $16.8 million a year comes from the state direct aids through the general fund. We expect to receive those monies over the next 30 years to help pay off the deficit. Our unfunded liability rose because of the Minneapolis merger to about $1.6 billion. We did receive the contribution streams we need to pay off that deficit, but it will take 30 years of receipts to pay that off.
I'll ask you, we don't have the legislative auditor's report in front of us. Were there any comments that you wish to make regarding their views on the post fund?
Mr. Chair, we received questions at TRA. Did the Minneapolis merger affect the post-retirement fund deficit? It did vary slightly, perhaps, but the post-fund deficit pre-existed the Minneapolis merger issue, if that is your...
Well, overall, do you have a post-fund issue?
Yes, we do, and we are going to present something further on that, and I can illustrate at that time the effect on TRA, which is fairly significant.
Okay. I think many members, you know, I think I'm the only one on currently has been on the Pension Commission. I'm sure members get questions about the Rule of 90, and that, of course, is a TRA issue. Obviously, that's a policy issue the legislature has to decide. Maybe if you could provide some information to the committee members, because I'm sure they're going to get questions from their own constituents on that, if you could go into that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There was a bill introduced last week, House File 547, extending the Rule of 90 benefits to our Tier 2 members. The Tier 2 members are those teachers who were first hired July 1st, 1989 and later. And people are quite surprised when we tell them that that constitutes two-thirds of our active membership now, just about two-thirds. And the weakness we have in our benefit provision is that many of these younger teachers first hired since 1989 are starting to do some financial planning, and they're learning that they do not qualify for the Rule of 90 and have to teach until age 66 for full retirement benefits. So we are getting more questions relating to the Tier 2 benefit and the lack of Rule of 90 for these individuals.
Senator Lumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I've discussed Rule of 90 in the past, it was always considered for legislative approval for an idea maybe to clear out older or more experienced teachers, pushing that high salary cost away from a district, giving them what was considered not their mandatory retirement age, but an earlier retirement opportunity. Are you telling us that newer, younger teachers believe that they should have a Rule of 90 as kind of a standard expectation? Because Rule of 90 was not really considered kind of a norm. It was considered an opportunity to free up salaries and expenses for school districts at the same time giving them the earlier qualifications to, in fact, retire at an earlier time than they normally did. I never thought it was considered and maybe it has become that way, an expectation that Rule of 90 is to be the actual formula for retirement. Could you tell me about what kind of expectations that younger teachers are now assuming?
And just to be clear, I don't think Mr. Wakeland is here to support or oppose the Rule of 90. I asked him to kind of describe it from the fund standpoint because ultimately the decision would be a legislative one. But I figured as long as he's here and you may be hearing from your own constituents about it, you might want to hear from the fund. You'll certainly have opportunities, I think, to talk to the stakeholders at that. But, Mr. Wakeland, did you want to talk about it from the fund's viewpoint?
Senators, from the fund's viewpoint is that currently the TRA fund is running a slight deficiency. As I indicated, we have a $1.6 billion unfunded liability in our active fund, even before we deal with the post-fund problem. And Rule of 90 would cost additional contributions. I don't have an updated number. We did some costing of Rule of 90 prior to the Minneapolis merger, but since the merger, we have not updated those costs. But there are groups interested in Rule of 90, and I can't speak for Education Minnesota, but I know that is one of their highest priorities with retirement.
Any other questions of TRA? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering on the full-time equivalents, it looks like it's been fairly steady, projected to go up about 4 in the coming years. Did you go through a time when you were doing some employee cutting during the time when administration was cut across the board throughout state government and everybody was trimming a little bit, or because this only goes back to 2006, so I'm just wondering about, like, in 2003, 2004, did you have less than this, or have you been pretty constant here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think we were slightly higher at one time. We've had our own retirement issues at TRA, and there's been several positions we have not filled. The growth there is we did inherit 8 employees from the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Association. A couple of those people have left for other opportunities, but it's apparent we needed to add some people to deal with the Minneapolis issue with their expertise and unique knowledge base. And that's the growth that you see there.
So in the long run, do you expect that at some point you're not going to have to, when Minneapolis is fully merged, if you've dealt with those issues, you won't need those employees anymore, or what, do you have a long-range view?
Mr. Chair, with attrition and the aging of employees is that we hope we're going to be able to manage our employee needs just through attrition and keep this fairly constant.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, the handout that we got from TRA, the numbers are different than in our budget book. Is the handout more up-to-date or more accurate?
Senator Betzel, Senator Pappas, that is correct. We what you have in your book was a preliminary submission last October prior to the receipt of the final actuarial data and financial statements.
Okay.
You have a one-page handout in the back of your budget book. Second to the last tab is the retirement cost. Further questions? Senator Wilson.
One of my questions would be about the inactive members. And is that like if a teacher were to teach for 10 years and leave the profession, then they would be an inactive member? Is all your accruing, does that account for that group of teachers in the retirement numbers?
Mr. Wicklund.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, our inactive members, we have about 12,000 of those folks who are actually vested. That is, they've taught long enough to receive a monthly benefit, but they're no longer actively in the classroom. Another 20,000 or so who have left the teaching profession, but they've left their money with us, but they're not vested for a monthly benefit at some point down the road. These individuals indeed may come back to teach, and they also may be teaching at one of our other teacher funds, or they could have combined service with PERA or MSRS as well.
And I think PERA can be better to describe this, but one of the things that was throwing off the actuarial numbers before was it used to be that people would start in a profession, pay their money in, and then leave the profession and take the money out. And more in recent years, people are leaving their money in because of uncertainty over retirements. And that has thrown off some of the assumptions as to how many people are going to retire, and it's caused some deficits. Senator Pappas, do you have a question?
Yeah, how many years do you need to be vested?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, it's 3 years, as long as your service was after May 16th of 1989, which is practically everyone now today.
Other questions? You're not going to get much of a pension at that
yeah.
But people are concerned about that, and they're leaving the money in the plan, so, which creates some liabilities down the road. No questions. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Whiteland.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Then, now, PERA, Mary Vanek. And welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the director of PERA, and with me today is our assistant director, Dave DeYoung. I'll just give you a brief overview of what PERA is, and then Mr. DeYoung will go over our numbers. PERA covers all local government employees, including the non-teaching school district employees. Membership-wise, we are the largest of the three statewide funds with just under 160,000 active members. We have just under 40,000 inactive members and are paying benefits to a little over 66,000 individuals. We currently have assets of $16.7 billion and our contribution rates in our largest plan, our general employee plan, and our police and fire plan, are gradually increasing. over the next 2 to 3 years to take into account some funding shortfalls we've had in the past. And we can talk a little bit more about that if you'd like to. But first, I'd like to have Mr. DeYoung report to you our revenue and expenditure numbers.
Mr. Chair and members, you should also have a
Could you identify yourself for the record, so? What's your name?
My name is Dave DeYoung.
Thank you.
Assistant Director at PERA.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Should have a one-page supplement. We don't get any direct appropriations from the state. We have an 11-person board who approves our expenditures and our revenues. But they are here. We are, for expenditures at the top, we are anticipating $2.6 billion in expenditures. 99% of those are due to benefits and refunds. And in revenues, our revenues are increasing at about a 9% rate due to the increase in our contribution rates that were passed a couple of years ago. We're anticipating revenues in this next biennium of about $1.6 billion. Do you have any questions?
And revenues are the ones that people are paying in for the current employees?
Contributions from current employees.
As opposed to when they leave, when they get ready to retire, they move into the post fund, right?
Right.
Gotcha.
We pay the benefits from there.
Any further information, Ms. Vanek or Mr. DeYoung? Did you want to comment on anything on the legislative auditor's report here, or is there something forthcoming on that?
Mr. Chair, if you could wait, we'd like to, the three funds together, would like to just go over a brief presentation we have in response to the report.
Sure. Okay. Again, I'm more familiar with it because I'm on the Pensions Commission. Could you maybe just discuss the issue we had that I alluded to a minute ago about a few years ago where you had the billion-dollar shortfall or problem and why things are changing in the retirement area that we need to be sensitive about?
Certainly. Mr. Chair and members, in 1997, the actuary retained by the commission at the time, the Legislative Commission on Pensions at the time, did what we call an experience study. And an experience study is done every 4 years to check to see if the assumptions we're making about the demographics of our membership in terms of how many people are coming into the system, how many are retiring, how long are they living, and our economic assumptions related to our salary and payroll growth and our investment returns, that study is done every 4 years. Well, in the study that was done in 1997, information confirming an earlier study result found that PERA's membership wasn't turning over as much as we had expected. Two things were going on. People who were leaving the system who had vested were not taking out their money. They were leaving their money in the fund in anticipation of a benefit in the future. Prior to that, we saw more of those individuals actually taking a refund and forfeiting their benefit rights. So that was a significant issue. Another factor was that people, once they were coming into the system, especially in the school districts at older ages, were not leaving, were staying. And we were expecting that more of them would be terminating service and we would gain from that. When you look at our numbers of just under 40,000 deferred members, about half of those have between 3 and 5 years of service. So when the vesting was reduced to 3 years in 1989, it had a significant impact on PERA's numbers relative to this, what we call our deferred or inactive folks. And Senator Betzold was on the commission at the time, and we learned that it increased, even though we had done some changes to help the funding of PERA in 1997 in a major pension bill. The results of that study that came out shortly after session was over determined that PERA was actually about 2% short in contributions that we were collecting because of this activity with members staying in longer and those who had left deferring their accounts. So it was a significant issue undertaken by the commission over the next years following. We finally resolved, I think resolved it sufficiently in 2005 with some contribution increases that were enacted by the legislature.
Contribution increases, of course, come from tax dollars and from the employees. It's employer-employee. That's how we pay for pensions. Any questions of PERA? Any questions?
Well, thank you, Ms. Vanek. And then the final one we have today is MSRS. And for every legislator that's been elected since 1996, you are a member of MSRS. So this is your plan. Now, prior to 1996, we had a separate legislative plan. It was only for legislators. Legislators could have opted to go into the MSRS plan or stay in the old plan. But if you're since 1996, you have no choice. This is the plan you're in. So, welcome to the Budget Division. And how's that for a setup? Please identify yourself for the record. I think they're going to pay very close attention to what you're going to say.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the State Retirement System. Just briefly, we cover state employees, non-faculty University of Minnesota employees, employees of the Met Council, and MinSCU employees who are not faculty. You heard about the membership of the other plan. We are the third largest in the state. We have about 54,000 active employees. We've got about 16,000 inactive members, and we're currently paying a little over 27,000 benefit recipients. We do administer quite a few different plans. Our largest is our General Employees Retirement Plan. That is by far our largest. That's what most employees pay into. We administer a State Patrol Plan, a Correctional Employees Retirement Plan, the Judges Plan, the Legislators Plan that Senator Betzold alluded to, a plan for constitutional officers, and then for those employees that were, or legislators that were hired after the 96-97 period, you are in our unclassified plan, which is a defined contribution plan. We also administer a deferred compensation plan, the State of Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan. That has about $3 billion in it. We administer a health care savings plan with about $150 million. Our retirement plan assets are just under $10 billion. So just to put all of that in context. From a budget standpoint, most of the money we get comes from contributions, and most of the money we spend come from contributions and earnings. We do get appropriations for retirees in the legislator's plan and the constitutional officer's plan. That those two plans went to pay-as-you-go in 2005. The way a pay-as-you-go plan goes is we get the money in to pay the benefits each month, and we pay it out each month. The rest of our retirement plans, we collect contributions, and we invest that money and earn it. The legislator's plan and the constitutional officer's plan is unique, where that is not the case. We actually do not have a plan for them. We need an appropriation in order to pay those benefits. What we are, from a general fund appropriation, in 08, we're looking at $1.4 million, in 09, $1.469 million, so a total of about $3 million for the biennium. I would guess we're going to be updating those numbers now that the elections are over. We have more data on retirements, so in then March, when we put together the numbers for March, they may change. But these two plans that we have are very unique in the fact that they are not pre-funded plans. They're pay-as-you-go. So we get the money in and pay it out as we are paying monthly checks. The legislators that retired before 2005, when they retired, we transferred the money to our post-retirement account to pay for those, and that we then take out of that post-retirement account to pay their benefits on an ongoing basis. So there is a little distinction there as well.
And were you affected by the legislative auditor's report, or did they make any recommendations or things on MSRS?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, they did make some recommendations of which we don't disagree with, and one of the things that we'd like to do is the three of us have a short presentation, and we'd like to talk about that
sure.
as well.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Bergstrom? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been kind of tracking the staff for each of these retirement funds and trying to figure out what the correlation is. The MSRS has the equivalent of 84 full-time equivalent, and they have active memberships of about 55,000, and PERA is has employment of FTE of 91, and their active membership is actually three times higher, and their assets are almost twice as high. And TRA has 79,000 active members, and their assets are about the same, but they have, what did they have? TRA was, the first one we talked about was 86. And so I'm thinking that obviously if you have more members, you would have more activity taking in payments, dispensing payments, that sort of thing. So I'm trying to figure out what, how we come to almost the same number of employees in each of the funds when the memberships and the assets are quite different.
Well, you can obviously speak for your own fund, but Ms. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the key difference for us is that we administer the deferred compensation program. So in addition to the 50,000 employees that you see or so in the budget, that deferred compensation plan has another 80,000 members who participate in that. We also administer a healthcare savings plan with over 20,000 active members. And those take quite a bit of cost, quite a bit of staff. In 2004, we actually took over the administration of the deferred comp plan that used to be handled by private companies. So in that regard, we had to increase our staff size. We needed to increase our administrative costs. So if you took our 50,000 retirees, our roughly 80,000 members of our deferred comp plan and 20,000 of our health care savings plan, we're more in line with the other plans as far as the total number of staff and our administrative costs. By bringing in the deferred comp plan 3 years ago, we actually lowered our cost by over $1 million a year by doing so, and we were able to lower our fees in that program substantially. So the numbers are misleading because we don't fit real well into this budget process. The deferred comp plan is kind of off to the side because it's funded through employee contributions. There's very little state money that goes into it because it's all through optional contributions.
Sir Roebling, were we interested in hearing from the other plans too?
Because there is a difference memberships and their and their full-time equivalents.
Why don't we see if there's other questions for this one, then we'll find out. Other questions for Mr. Bergstrom on MSRS? If not, Ms. Vanek and Mr. Wicklund, could you come on back to the witness table and maybe address the issue of the number of full-time employees and why the difference is between the fund balances you manage and employees you have? Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, when we just look at our defined benefit plan programs, the retirement programs that we administer, and we compare ourselves to our sister systems, we do service more members per staff person than they do, but we do not have the additional work that, for example, Mr. Bergstrom was speaking of with respect to the deferred compensation plan and the healthcare savings plan, which I know has significantly increased his staffing. We are comfortable that our staffing numbers are adequate. We're adding a couple of new staff people. We're going to the board actually next week to request an increase in staffing levels, primarily to train new people and teach new people more about the business, because we do anticipate several retirements, and we hope that by bringing people in early enough and getting them fully trained into the system, that when these retirements occur, we will not have to backfill them, because there's a significant need for knowledge transfer, and we have a very senior staff. I'd say at least a third of our staff have 25 or more years of service with PERA, and so we're all within a 5 to 7 year window of being eligible for retirement and likely will be retiring. So I expect the PERA's numbers will, staffing equivalents will decline over the next 10 years through natural attrition through retirements.
And Ms. Woodland?
Mr. Chair, I think our demographic profile of the TRA employees is similar as expressed by Ms. Vanek here as well. Another thing about TRA is that our board has always taken a very strong stance and ethic in pre-retirement counseling. So we have a number of staff that are exclusively devoted to pre-retirement counseling, and teachers have come to expect individual personalized counseling often multiple times prior to retirement, and I think that accounts for at least some of our numbers there.
Other questions? Mr. Roebling, anything further? No. Well, thank you. Okay. That's it for today's agenda. Anything further that any members wish to? Next Wednesday, we'll be meeting with the Finance and Disclosure. Oh, I'm sorry. What's? I'm sorry. Was there a presentation here? I'm sorry. I was aware of that. It wasn't on my agenda. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Senator Betzel.
I was going to send him on early today.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you. If we could just take a few minutes to address the legislative auditor report. You had asked a few questions.
Sure. And that's this. Okay. Thank
right.
you.
And we won't take too much of your time. And, okay. What you heard about the legislative auditor, and they referenced the $4 billion in the post fund, the deficit in that fund. And we do agree that $4 billion is a significant portion of money. However, we do think it's very manageable. We do not see it to be a crisis. And we've been dealing with this issue for the last several years. Last year, Senator Betzel and Senator Pogemiller took the initiative, along with the rest of the Pension Commission, to pass a 5% cap on our post-retirement increases. As a practical matter, we will not be paying anything over the inflation rate up to 2.5% until that post fund is fully funded, and we'll go into that a little bit later. So effectively right now we will pay inflation up to 2.5% for the foreseeable future. We did testify in many meetings and hearings in front of various committees in both the House and the Senate. We do agree with the auditor's report on recognizing the deficit in the post fund when we do our actuarial numbers. That is something that is in the current processes in state law and in the Pension Commission framework that we need to do our actuarial work, and we're looking at making some changes for that. What we'd maybe like to do, you have a handout in front of you, and just take a step back. We already talked about the first page. It has the sort of who we are page on the front. And since we all discussed that in our budget, we'll just skip through that and go from there. And the revenues that we get, roughly about 13% of the revenues that we take in are from employee contributions. We get about 15% from employer contributions. And one of the keys to being a pre-funded retirement plan, that 72% of our income on average comes from investment return, and that's critical in our programs. We are not a pay-as-you-go system like Social Security. We actually have assets built up, significant assets, to pay current and future liabilities. And then it shows our expenditures. About 94% of our money goes to pay retirement benefits, 3% refunds, and then the rest in administrative and investment expenses. Mr. Bicker already talked about his return. We assume that we're going to earn 8.5% going forward. That's what the actuary is comfortable with. That is not unlike many private pension plans do as well. They assume 8.5%. That's a very common number. And long term, it does show that we have exceeded a 10% return as well.
The next page, Mr. Chair, I'll pick up. Post-retirement fund. Post fund is not a new phenomenon, although it is unique to Minnesota. The predecessor of the post fund was created in 1969, and it was created due to concerns raised by retirees that none of the pension funds were very well funded at the time, and they wanted to make sure that the money to pay their benefits was set aside separately and insured and protected, that they would have that money would be there to pay them. The original design of the earlier post fund did not produce benefit increases. The legislature did appropriate money for a couple of increases to be paid throughout the 70s, but it wasn't working as designed. So in 1980, the post fund was created, and that fund, as created in the 80s, was designed to pay benefit increases off of actual realized returns. So it was actual money earned and coming in to the post fund that then was redistributed in the form of benefit improvements or benefit increases annually to the retirees. What happened, however, throughout the 80s is that this fund that was invested, half of it in equities early in the 80s and half in bonds, soon became almost totally invested in bonds. 86% of it was in bonds by the end of the decade of the 80s. And that was really a result of more and more people retiring, needed that cash flow to pay benefits whenever. But the benefit increases were handsome in the 80s whenever stocks were sold and the capital gains realized on those stocks. And Mr. Bicker and his staff came to the retirement funds in the late 80s to say that they were very concerned about minimally meeting the required return we needed in the post and then generating money to pay increases beyond that. Because what happens when somebody retires is that we move money from the active fund to the post fund. We assume that the SBI will make a certain percentage to fully fund that person's benefit throughout their lifetime. Currently, that's 6%. So when we transfer money, we really transfer at a discounted rate of 6%. For example, one transfer sticks in my mind, and so I use this as an example. We recently had to pay a survivor benefit to a younger survivor, and we projected that the cost of that benefit over the survivor's lifetime was going to be about $1 million payout. We transferred to the post fund $346,000, assuming that if the state board would consistently make that 6% on that $346,000 transfer, the $1 million over the life expectancy of the individual would be there to pay that benefit. So that's how it works. Then anything earned over and above the 6% up to 2.5% pays that automatic or that guaranteed inflation increase that Mr. Bergstrom talked about, of the inflation up to 2.5%. Therefore, the assumed rate of return or the expectation that we all have is that the State Board of Investment will earn 8.5% on the assets that are invested through the post. What's happened as a result of some changes we then made in early 1990s to the post is that we changed the mechanism for paying increases. We, in 1992, legislation was passed that says that the increases paid to participants in the post will be that inflation guarantee we just described, and then any gains or market value over and above 100% would be shared one-fifth at a time with the retirees. If you go to the second page, what happened in the 90s is the stock market increased the value of the post fund significantly. So by 1998, we had 134% in the post fund of what we had to pay out over the lifetime of those participants. Now, we started to get pretty concerned at that point in time that we had paid some pretty phenomenal increases. There was a lot of money in the post, and what would happen if there was a market correction. So it was about in 1998 that the State Board staff and the Retirement Board staffs started talking about what can we do differently. We did run by some legislation to make a change. Senator Roebling introduced a bill for us, I believe it was in 2000, that would have, instead of paying out that excess market value one-fifth at a time, would have spread it out over 10 years, or so one-tenth at a time. And the idea was that we would keep more of those excess assets in the post to offset a market correction. Well, we didn't do a good job of marketing that proposal. We had more people come to members of the legislature saying we were screaming the sky is falling, there wasn't any need for this correction, And so we didn't get any real activity on that bill that was proposed. So the market corrected not only 1 year, but 3 years in a row. So you can see by 2003, we had dropped to 76% funded. At that point in time, we were coming to the legislature and proposing in 2004, at a minimum, capping future increases when the post fund did correct at 5%. And you did pass that for us last year. We did also try to make sure understood that the 5% cap was not intended to add any more money to the fund or correct the deficit that was there, that we may have to come back. And we are now in full agreement of the OLA's report. We were very much aware starting, you know, early last year that we needed to start working on this issue and coming up with something to fix this deficit going forward. We have time to fix it. We have $22 billion in the fund. We have $26 billion in obligations. So it does need to be corrected. So we have the full amount of money to cover those payments, but we do have time. So rather than taking the chance that we did previous legislation that we introduced to try to help the situation, we are going to be working with our boards in coming up with a recommendation, then educating our membership, retired, active, the deferred folks on why it's necessary to make the changes and move something forward in order. But in making these changes, it does have an impact on our fund, and Mr. Wicklund is going to describe for you what the chart on the next page means.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Rowley.
Just a quick comment, and this is a lesson that I hope legislators remember, is that
listen to your bills.
We shouldn't wait for the sky to fall. We should listen when there's projections that it could and take heed, and we would not have found ourselves in quite this predicament that we did a couple years ago.
You're saying I told you so. Yeah, okay, that's fine. You're entitled to. Okay, Mr. Wicklund, I guess we're on the page that says combining active and post fund. Is that what you want?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senators.
Sir Limmer.
On this point, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vanek, I don't know if this was the Minnesota Public Retirement Account, but I've heard that once post funds were generating an additional benefit, that additional benefit was represented in an additional payment to beneficiaries. When the market would do poorly, when it would drop, did the account reflect that drop as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the structure as it currently exists pays out when there are excesses in the form of permanent benefit adjustments upward, mm-hmm. but when the market corrects, there is no mechanism to adjust anything down.
Ms. Chair, is the term permanent market, what did you use, permanent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, permanent benefit adjustments.
Permanent benefit adjustments. Is that kind of a misnomer? Should we even use that term in the future? Does it lead us down a path where we're just going to trigger eventually some type of negative cash flow?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the structure as it currently exists says that once that increase is awarded, it becomes a permanent part of the base benefit paid. Part of the discussions we will be having over the several months in looking at what is the appropriate direction to go into the future will entertain that exact discussion about whether or not when there are excesses to share, should they be a part of the permanent base of the benefit or should they be some kind of supplemental one-time payment. That's just one of the many things we need to study and discuss in coming forth with a new proposal.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vanek, when that account started, or when the investments in Wall Street, I'm assuming Wall Street or any other collection of investments that was made, as that began to slip in relationship to the benefits that were paid out, that went on for a while, didn't it? It didn't just happen and then we quickly brought it to everyone's attention. It seems to have lasted a while, and tell me how your board tried to correct that as they began to see that slippage. Was there ongoing discussions? Were there policy directions that were changed?
Well, and the legislature obviously had to approve anything. Let me add something in here, and I'll throw it open to not only Ms. Vanek, but the other fund directors want to discuss it. Senator Hand asked a question during the Legislative Auditor Commission about the issue of defined contributions and defined benefits. Defined benefits means like high five. You know, you take your high five salaries and you know what your benefits are going to be. As opposed to contributions, you know what you're going to contribute, and if the stock market goes up or if the investments are good, you're going to get better than if we don't have a healthy economy. As I recall, one of the problems that we'd had was in the late 90s, we'd had a very good economy, very good stock market, very good returns from the funds. But and if you saw the graphs that they had in the auditor's report, in the early 90s, they show a big spike, which represents inflation. And a couple of years later, there's another big spike for the benefit increases. Well, what happened was a lot of people were saying, the level of retirements that we're getting right now has been eaten away by inflation that we've had over the last couple of years, so we'd like to have it bumped up so we can stay ahead of inflation. And, of course, at the time, everybody thought that the economy is going to go that way forever, and so it seemed okay to do it. Well, of course, the benefits were bumped up, and then, of course, things dropped off. But once you raise the level of benefits, it's kind of hard to go backwards and say, well, now let's cut them back. I mean, once you especially when you're trying to keep ahead of inflation. But the situation that you can't get in is trying to mix and match defined benefits and defined contributions. You got one or the other. When you try to make them both, I don't know what you have. But let me throw it back to the funds and see what your take on is. Okay. Ms. Vanek or
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. Notice these on the chart, the years represent fiscal years. So June 30th, 2003, we noticed that there was we were at 76% funded in the post. We started talking about what do we do going forward with this. Now if you look at 2004, we recovered significantly. The structure of the post that's legislated says that any excess investment earnings above 8.5% when the post is less than 100% funded remain in the fund to get it back to full funding. Well, when we saw that within one fiscal year, based on the performance of SBI's investments, we had recovered almost $1 billion, we thought, well, perhaps this will work, but we wanted to keep an eye on it. By the next year, we had progressed from 81 to 82% funding. We started having some serious discussions about we need to address this. This is, unfortunately, as you well know in this process, slow and laborious and needs a lot of careful study because we are affecting the lives of a lot of people. There are 130,000 benefit recipients drawing their monthly checks out of the post fund, and you need to educate them about what this means, plus the active members, many of whom saw what the increases were in the late 90s, who said, well, the structure works, so once the market rebounds, we get our shot at those. Well, we're saying now, as the Legislative Auditor's Report has supported, that this isn't a reasonable design for paying adjustments, that there should be something that gives us a little better prediction of what our long-term liabilities are going to be. We'll make sure that we don't have winners and losers so that there won't be a generation of people who get an over 9% average annual increase and then a generation who gets 2.5%. So we need to go back and educate our, come up with a reasonable approach, educate our membership, get their buy-in so that when we bring it to you, you don't hear from your constituencies, don't support that. So that's the work we have ahead of us for the next year.
And some of those reforms, by the way, the Senate passed on a bipartisan basis. We just couldn't get the House to go along with them for a couple of years. Anybody else want to comment on this issue?
Well, Senator, the Pension Commission has a study that they're on this very issue as well. And I just think that, you know, we've really had several post funds, and we really want to get it right. When this was created in the 70s, we went about 10 years, and we had a formula that didn't pay any increases.
during high inflation, as Senator, so that didn't work. Then in the 80s, we had a formula that forced us almost all of our investments into bonds, which over time would not yield as much as having some money in the stock market. Then in the 90s, we put in a different formula, and no one anticipated a run-up in the market like we had, followed by that severe of a drop. If the market had gone up and down slowly over time, we wouldn't be talking about this today. So we want to make sure we study it, come back in 08, so we, for the fourth time, this formula would work for us. And then I think we need to keep this in context as well, which John can talk about, is what our funding still looks like and, you know, are our contributions sufficient? So maybe if we could go to that, we might kind of put all of this into sort of the overall funding terms as well.
Senator Roberts, Chair, you made a comment that your investment pool was forced to go heavily into bonds. Could you tell me why that was forced? What's the forced nature of that?
Mr. Chair, at that point, the formula required that we have realized gains in order to pay out the benefit. Well, the stock market, you can't, it's not until you sell those stocks until you can do that. So it just was kind of the nature of how we had to invest the money to get recognized gains and actual money back. So, and Mr. Bicker probably could do a lot better job than I can, but it just kind of just ended up that way because the stock, you don't get the gain until you actually sell the stock. And so,
Ms. Vanek?
Well, Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I think also, if we recall, you were speaking earlier about the early retirement golden parachute idea. Well, the rule of 85 was enacted in 1984 for a two-year period of time. So there were a lot of retirements that occurred in that period of time, and there were a lot of people who were looking at the attractiveness of retirement. So I think Mr. Bicker found that for cash flow purposes, more and more money needed to be more liquid to pay the benefits for the increasing number of retirees, which forced the portfolio into that kind of a structure rather than keeping more in equities.
Any further questions? Mr. Licklin, did you want to describe this combining?
Yes. One of the potential solutions for resolving this post fund deficit is on this page with the big words combining active and post funds. And quite simply, it would just take the assets and liabilities of the post retirement fund and send them back to one of the three home retirement systems from where they came. Before we review the numbers, however, there's a couple of assumptions we need to explain to the group here prior to talking about them. Concerning the baseline now, the last two legislative sessions have increased employee and employer contribution rates for all three retirement systems. In the baseline, we assume that those contribution rate streams have been fully implemented. In reality, that has not happened. For TRA, it's going to happen July 1 of 2007, but for the other two systems represented here, it won't happen for another 3 years. When we look at the combining of the funds, it's not just the post-retirement fund deficit we're looking at here as well, but we had an actuarial experience study conducted in 2005, and these numbers also assume that various economic and demographic assumptions recommended by the actuary are implemented by the legislature at the same time. So we'll go over system by system here. With MSRS in their baseline, currently 96.2% funded. Their required contributions of 10.1, they're just slightly deficient at 0.1. If they would take their share of the post fund deficit back home, so to speak, their funding ratio would decline about 3.5%, and they'd be in roughly the same shape with their contribution rate deficiency. For PERA, their baseline right now is about 74.7. They have a statutory contribution rate of 13% in 2010. They're slightly sufficient using that assumption. If they would take their share of the post-fund deficit back and make these actuarial assumption changes, they'd be right about even at about 13%. Looking at TRA, the TRA baseline is about 92.6%. That's after the Minneapolis-TRA merger now. We have a required contribution rate of 12.1. We're slightly deficient at 0.3. However, taking the post fund back into TRA has a much larger effect on TRA than it does the other two systems. There's a couple reasons for that. But assuming that the post-fund deficit comes back into TRA, the resulting contribution rate deficiency is about 1.7%, which is a cause for concern and would require some legislative attention and funding to resolve.
So are you saying that combining them doesn't get us there?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not saying that. It's something that needs to be addressed as this option is pursued further.
I guess one of the things, and again, this is more the Pension Commission is going to have to deal with a lot of this, but I think these members also are going to have to be aware of it and voting on it. If I'm an older member already receiving retirement funds, would I not think it'd be a good idea to merge the active members, you know, the current employees with me so that I can have a more solid base for my pension? But if I'm a younger member currently working, would I not think, well, wait a minute, why merge my fund into the post fund so that I'm now guaranteeing the pensions, you know, that may be generous for some older employees when there's no guarantee that I'm going to get anything when I get to that stage? This isn't this something that could be raised at us?
Mr. Chair, that will undoubtedly be raised. The 1.7% does not assume that's from the employee or the employer. Yeah. It's just it's a percentage of payroll that's needed. Our payroll is about $3.5 billion. That number is roughly $60 million a year for 30 years.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, why don't we finish the last page?
Following pages, Mr. Chair, are just some attachments for your review. You have a composite benefit payment chart in front of you. All 87 counties are represented, 123,000 benefit recipients are paid a total of about $2.4 billion. And then also attached is a letter from the three retirement directors to the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, giving them an update on the board's progress in trying to address this issue.
Thank you. Any other questions from the members? Okay. Well, thank you. As I indicated, on Wednesday we'll be hearing from the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board, from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the Amateur Sports Commission. I think the goal of the Senate is to try to get the budget bills passed by the Senate by the Easter Passover break, which would be early April, which means we've got, this is the early part of February, so we've got maybe about a month and a half maybe to finish. Well, I think we're on track to do that. I don't think we have to have any Friday meetings to get there, but we will have to keep on pace to go through our parts of the budget. February forecast will be coming out in a few weeks, obviously. We're going to have to take those things into consideration, but considering everybody wants pay raises and computers and a few initiatives in here. But there's other things we have to look at to find out if the agencies are really saving money where they really say they are. So we're going to get in the bigger agencies the deeper we go. So, keep your pencil sharpened and stay tuned. So, any questions? Okay, well, thank you, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Thanks a lot. Meeting adjourned. Bye.